Accession number 27185, reel 12.
Major Batrash, reel 12.
There was a wicked rumour going round that we'd barbed wired two old ladies into a sun, one of those sun shelters on the promenade with their knitting, and that they stayed there the whole war whilst we poked food through the wire at them.
That's true.
I never saw them.
And you, I think you were saying that your system of indication where parachutists might have descended was very much admired and was taken up.
Well, we did get, yes, from the local, when a brigadier came and saw one of his walkabouts, he got the other battalion commanders who had also on our flanks from the same brigade to come and have a look. And I can't remember whether or not they went away and thought, well, that's a silly idea, or whether they went back and said, we have the same thing. They may not have been in the same position, of course, but they were along the South Downs at the back, I think all battalions were.
Have you any idea, you know, what gave you that notion?
I can't remember. It's something we worked up between us, I think. Mm. I don't know where the idea came from. I think it's when you sit there and you get on there and you think, you begin thinking, how am I going to tell people where they are, you know, and you just develop it from there.
Chanctonbury Rings, I think, was an Iron Age hill fort.
It probably was, yes. I can't.
Was your OP actually on a?
I can't remember now. I really can't.
How many men would you normally have in an OP?
Oh, just a couple.
Would they be up there permanently, or were they relieved at regular intervals?
Oh, they're relieved, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was sort of a standing patrol, really.
Mm. What did it consist of then? I mean, did you have any sort of building or anything like that?
No, it was just a hole in the ground with sandbags.
Sandbags.
Yeah. And camouflaged over the top with something. Because we had to be very careful that we didn't give the enemy reconnaissance planes if they came over any indication that there was positions there. So we had to be careful about the tracks we used and that the positions we dug were very carefully camouflaged over.
And where was the battalion headquarters to which they would report?
Well, we were in a house we'd taken over in the back, towards the back of Worthing itself. It was in a good position. It was near the main road. Mm-hmm. It was just off the main road, but on the main road leading down to the front. So yes, it was in a good position for communications. And further along, we had the officers' mess. Most of the time, we took over houses. Mm-hmm. Requisitioned, but there were no furniture in them.
And what did you have in the battalion command post or operations room? Do you remember how it was set up and equipped?
Well, I imagine it was like all battalion headquarters. I mean, we'd have the CO's office, the adjutant's office, and then there'd be a room where you have the maps. Where all the companies were shown, and a map of the district with the roads, chinagraph, where you could use a chinagraph pencil over talc, and the telephones. But that would be all, I think.
Were the maps on a table, or were they on a portable board?
We did have that later. Because going out on exercises and things like that. But at this stage, we probably did actually, because we did have exercises here. Mm. Although we were in a static defence position, there were brigade and battalion brigade and divisional exercises to make sure that we were, well, we didn't get too static minded, that we could also develop our skills in manoeuvring. And also, of course, if the Germans did come and they came somewhere else, we would probably be pulled out anyway and used as
a mobile
reserve somewhere. So we always had to be ready to go somewhere else. So we did have, I can remember, divisional exercises 2 or 3 days when we just let a skeleton skeleton staff behind or skeleton positions held by I just suppose held by skeletons. I mean, held by a few number of staff.
Do you remember what form those exercises took?
They were mostly all advanced to contact. There were certainly a lot on the road. We spent a lot of our time on the road. And then attacking. It was all advanced to contact and then attack.
Were these opposed exercises?
Were they?
Opposed. Could you have an enemy?
Oh, yes, there was usually somebody as an enemy, yes. I mean, some of the division would act as enemy. You didn't have to have many for an enemy, just enough around the place to throw thunder flashes or fire a rifle to give the impression of a platoon. I mean, you only had to have one or two people up on a hill. So quite often there would just be a company who would be told to go off and be the enemy.
You mentioned reconnaissance aircraft. Did you see a lot of enemy air activity?
Well, yes, we did actually. It wasn't so much reconnaissance. It was aircraft on their way to bomb or coming back from bombing. And I've just got a letter here because I used to, as battalion IO, I used to get reports of Germans who had. We finished up on the floor in the at the back somewhere on the downs, and I used to have to go off and try and locate them, I couldn't bring them in myself because I was on my motorbike, but I would get the police, or usually the police would do it, or if I needed an ambulance or somebody. But I got a little bit of reading here which might be of interest. I spent quite a lot of my time rounding up live or dead Bosch off the downs lately. Quite a number get shot down round these parts, both by day and night. I hope to get a spot of leave towards the end of June. I used to have to go out quite a bit, and I remember one occasion there was... usually they were quite docile by the time they'd had enough by then. But there was one guy who was badly wounded, and we got him back into hospital. And the next morning, I went down there to see if we'd get any information out of him, or you know how he was getting on. And I was met by a distraught doctor and said, "We can't do anything with this guy." He said, "He's Nazi crazy." And there he was, with no clothes on. They tried to put him on the operating theatre table because he'd got wounds and things. And he jumped off and was running around the hospital shouting out Heil Hitler and Engländer Schweinhund and that sort of thing. And I actually saw him. And the doctor said, "We could do nothing with this guy, you know, and he's just running around." I don't know what they did in the end.
Sounds as though he's a suitable candidate for a needle full of tranquilizer.
Well, I think they probably, yes. They probably hit him on the head with a blunt instrument.
I mean, do you remember what he was like when you picked him up?
I can't remember, no. I can't remember what he was like originally. I just remember going to the hospital. The sort of thing that would imprint itself on your mind when you see somebody running around like that with no clothes on shouting, "Ah, Hitler." But I can't remember what he was like when we picked him up.
Do you recollect if you did get any useful information from any of them?
Only vaguely. I know that I studied the one of the things which I did on my course. Did I mention I'd been on a intelligence course? Yes, I did, didn't I?
You did, but you didn't give any idea of the content or details of it.
Well, the sort of thing I learnt there on the intelligence course was in German army organisation, identification of their various arms of piping which they had on their coloured piping on their shoulders. If we could identify which regiments they were, or so much the better. And also, of course, tank recognition, aircraft recognition, which gave you sort of sheets of silhouettes.
Yes.
So that when I went out and saw these guys, I could have a silhouettes of the aircraft and see if they could identify the aircraft. Mm-hmm. At least I could say, find out what type of aircraft they were flying, and or where they came from. But I don't remember getting very much out of them. I probably did on the odd occasion.
Were you able to speak German?
Nein.
Ein
bisschen. Ein kleines bisschen. No, not very much at that stage. There was a course later, which before D-Day, which the company commanders went on, which was, to my mind, a bit of a waste of time. We spent 3 days. The idea was that we would interrogate ourselves, any prisoners we caught in the field. So you were, you learnt to ask, which division are you? And so forth. But if the chap started talking to you volubly in German, you wouldn't understand a word he was saying. So that was the only time I think anybody ever attempted to help me speak German, although I did learn quite a bit later when I was stationed in Germany.
Did any of these guys, when you were at Worthing, speak any English? Were you able to get anything out of them that way?
You mean the ones we picked up?
Yes, the German aircraft.
I can't remember now. So long ago. I mean, we used to... I was surprised by reading that, how much I'd actually done. I can remember doing it. And then, of course, some of them used to drop their bombs around the place. So either they'd drop them because by mistake, or else they just dropped them and went home rather than go to London. But we weren't a target. Although later there was hit and run, which I will mention. I was a target once on the beach. But there were a couple of things which happened there which were of interest. Our divisional commander and brigade commander walked straight into a minefield.
How did they manage to do
at
that?
Shoreham.
Was it not marked?
Yes. I don't know to this day how on earth they were allowed to get in there. One got killed and the other got badly wounded. And I can't remember which it was. I think the brigadier got killed and the divisional commander got badly wounded. And that meant that we lost our CO because Henry Bless then became promoted to brigadier to command 25 Brigade. But how on earth two senior officers like that were ever allowed to get into a minefield, I don't know. But it happened. The other thing which shows a little bit of the character of Henry Blest, our CO, as I said, I used to go around the companies with him sometimes when he walked round, and he'd go around like all good COs without sort of saying, I'm coming. I mean, just
turn up.
Just walk round, yeah. Talk to people. And we arrived at the one company headquarters, I can't remember which it was, and the company commander was called Major Lafferty. He was another Irishman from the old days. And he was one of the older ones. He didn't stay very much longer after this. And he was a company commander. And we got to the back door of this hotel where there was a sentry. And it was, oh, Corporal Stoddart, I remember so well, because he was with me on the train in France. And he was on sort of standing as a sentry outside, or orderly. And Bless got out of his car and he walked up to the door and he said to Stoddart, I want to see Major Lafferty. And he did mumble a bit. He said, I want to see Major Lafferty. And that's all. So Corporal Stoddart said, sir, open the door, and led the way up some back stairs there. Got to the landing, opened up the door, and there was a beautiful lavatory there. And this is where Bless absolutely blew his top, because he had a short fuse. I mean, you remember he had ginger hair, I had told you. And he said, he just looked at this chap and he says, I don't want that, you bloody fool. He said, I want your company commander. And poor old Corporal Stoddart was taken aback. He couldn't understand it at all. But he used to play afterwards, because he thought it was very funny. But there we were, up the stairs in this lavatory. The other thing which happened there, which brings in the Home Guard a bit, some of us young officers used to get into recreational transport, which we were permitted to have and pay for, and go into Brighton for the evening, where we would meet some of the other young officers from other battalions down there, because we're all the same division. And one day we were going in, and actually it wasn't recreational transport, it was a taxi on this occasion we'd taken. There were about three or four of us in this taxi. And we were going along Brighton front, and all of a sudden there was an almighty bang from behind. And taxi stopped, and I could see the taxi driver wasn't very happy. And all of a sudden, we heard a sort of approaching boots from the back. And a home guard appeared at the window with a rifle in his hand. And he said, "You ought to stop, you ought to stop," he said. And I said, did you fire a round just then? He said, "Yeah, I did." He said, "I called stop and he didn't." So I said, "Well, where were you aiming?" He said, "I was aiming at the back of the taxi, where I was sitting." And that was the sort of thing some of the Home Guard did in those days. You know, they were sort of thought they were doing their job. They were on the ball. I don't know what he thought we were.
Was there any sign of a barrier or a roadblock of any sort?
I can't remember at all. I just remember this bang. Taxi drew up with a screening of tyres. And there's Home Guard appearing at the window with his rifle, having tried to shoot me. So,
were there any repercussions?
I expect there were, yes. I'm sure it was reported. I don't know quite what happened. We went into Brighton and had a good stiff whiskey, I think, after that.
And you say that Henry Blest got promoted and he went up to... Brigadier.
Yes, yes.
Who took his place?
Well, we had I made a note of his name. God, he was with us for 4 years. That's what old age does to you. It knocks your mind a memory. Bill Marriott became our CO.
What sort of character was he?
He was what you would call a steady, pipe-smoking chap. He was excellent for the job at that time. I think he was a First War soldier. He was in his mid-40s, I think. He was very good at administration. He was very, very good at training. He didn't have the character that Blest had. I mean, he wasn't a charismatic sort of individual. But he was a good CO, a good, steady CO. And he was with us for nearly... Well, from that time up until about 2 or 3 months before D-Day. And he was just the job for that time. He had a dry sense of humour. He has a human attitude to things. He was a good disciplinarian, as far as I remember. He was well liked by people. But he wasn't what you might call an outstanding leader. But he was very good for the job at that time.
How did he use his adjutant then? Did he depend on his adjutant more or less than Henry Blest had?
I think he got a much younger and inexperienced CO adjutant after that, because David Longprice moved, and I don't quite sure where he was moved to. Perhaps he had a company. He took as his adjutant one Michael Holm, who had joined us from Octu in France, but just in March, just before the war actually started in earnest. And I imagine that although he was excellent, he was a very good officer, he was so good that he later stayed on and became a Major General in the end. And I met him the other day again, not long ago. But he would, at that stage of his career, he wouldn't have had a lot of experience. So I imagine that he was probably controlled more, initially anyway. I mean, as time went by, probably Bill Marriott thought he could lengthen the lead a bit. He would want to. He wouldn't want to be in on every detail all the time. So as Mike got experience, no doubt he got better and better and turned out to be a good adjutant. So he got more and more string. But I think as characters, I think Bill Marriott would probably feel he wanted to be in on things more, perhaps, than Blest was, who stood back more.
So Marriott was more interested in the day-to-day running of the battalion?
Yes, I think he probably was, yes, yeah. I didn't mean to say that Blest was disinterested in the running of battalion, but he was more inclined to leave it to his adjutant and other people, and kept a firm hand on things from the back. because he was a good CO, blessed, very good, and he became a good brigadier. He stayed in command of 25 Brigade for the rest of the war, actually, because he was too old for anything else. I mean, he was in his 50s by then, and he wasn't sort of one of Monty's young men, exactly.
Montgomery seemed to have very rigid ideas about age.
Who, Monty?
Yes.
I think he probably did, yeah. He made himself... Well, I think he was probably right, because we had learnt in the BEF days that being old was all right with experience and that sort of thing, but when it came to flexibility and mental attitudes and so forth, it didn't work. So he when he took over any command or whatever, he weeded out the older blokes, I think, and what his favourite expression was tell him to pack his bags. That was his favourite expression, pack your bags. So we heard. So he did weed out, yeah. But by the time we got to into 21st Army Group, of course, we were all young anyway, so he didn't bother us too much.
you would say that you've been promoted. You've gone up from being a second lieutenant to a lieutenant.
Yes.
Does that make any material difference in your life day to day?
No, not really. I just had another pip on my shoulder and got a little extra pay. Didn't make any difference, really.
You're still doing the same sorts of...
Well, I was still battalion IO at that stage. I don't know whether the second lieutenants felt they looked up at me for having another pip on my shoulder. I doubt it very much. Probably I had a little bit of kudos being in battalion headquarters and being assistant adjutant and so forth, and going around with the CO. They probably thought I knew a lot more than I actually did. It was always a feeling that anybody was mixed up with the senior officers or anything like that. Must know what was going on and what was going to happen, but you very often didn't.
Were there any serious invasion scares while you were guarding the front of them?
No, I don't remember standing to. I mean, we had stand twos, obviously, practice ones, and when we had full manning and that sort of thing. but I know there weren't any. Of course, the other thing which I remember, I had to do checks. We all had to do checks of people. It didn't matter who they were. I could stop anybody in the restricted area and ask for what they were doing there. I had to go around on my motorbike stopping people. It's quite hilarious sometimes.
I can't find anybody suspicious.
No, unfortunately not. No, most of them were just either people who live locally or else have lost their way or something. They're all bona fide people.
How did they react when you stopped them?
Oh, very reasonably. We had a little chat, and some of them had a few laughs sometimes. It's really a question of how you treated them. I mean, if you treated them in a sort of an official, overbearing way, then they obviously, so okay, here you are. Showed them their pass or whatever it was they had. But, I mean, if you treated them like human beings and they didn't get the impression that you felt that you was being a superior sort of individual looking into their private lives, I usually found it was good to have a few jokes about things and send them off happy on their way.
You were saying that you did quite a lot of movement when you were doing the bigger exercises.
Yes.
Divisional and so forth. Where did those exercises take place? Were they on the downs?
Yeah, normally at the back, behind Worthing, Brighton and all behind there, yes.
And did you get caught up in any of these large schemes that ended up with concentration on Salisbury Plain? And
no, we never got as far north as that, no. There was Excise Bumper.
Yes.
Now, I can't remember when that took place. Round about this time, I think, or perhaps when we moved later.
Yes.
I think Bumper took place later. We couldn't have done. I must have been battalion IO at the time.
Yes.
Because I was told to go with a few chaps on my motorbike and cause sabotage behind the lines. Now you can imagine what fun I had doing that, and I did too. I mean, I remember we went off, and I had about two or three of us, and hid up in a farm somewhere. And we used to go out and turn the signpost round So the convoys all went down the wrong place. Or else we would go off and ambush and fire from the side of the roads and then disappear. And we caused absolute havoc, actually, so much that they decided to take us out. I don't think we would have got away with it all, what we did. But I remember being very indignant when the umpire came along with a white armband and said, "I'm sorry, but you've all been shot or bombed." And I said, "But nobody knows we're here, you know." And he said, "No, I'm sorry, you've just got to go." I can remember being quite indignant that I'd been found when I thought I shouldn't have been.
What was the purpose of the bumper? What kind of...
It was a huge exercise. I think it was the biggest exercise that had been done. I think it was to exercise command, really, more than anything else, because one has to remember that at that stage, a lot of our senior commanders were rather like the Americans were when they came in the war. They had little experience, although they probably had more frontline experience than the Americans' senior generals had. But they did need practice as division corps commanders. Managing a formation in the field.
When you were doing these exercises, in particular the divisional ones, the advances to contact, were there any changes in the tactics that you remember of how you would conduct an advance to contact? And
I'm sure when we when we had post-mortem, as we used to call them after the exercises, that it all came up that we could do something a bit better than we did it before. But we had evolved a system, which I'm not sure, I think I mentioned this before, where we had, we operated in groups, of all arms groups, which we'd not thought of before.
Yes.
Where advance party, if you were going advance to contact, and we were thinking more of these lines now, advance to contact, you would have a company, infantry company up front with a section of carriers, a section of mortars, probably an FOO from the artillery, and probably that would be it. And then you would then have a tactical headquarters, battalion tactical headquarters. Instead of the battalion headquarters moving as a great big body, the CO would then take his battalion IO, a couple of clerks, and the radio, which was the command set for the battalion network, also with the rear link to the brigade, which would be a 19 set,
yes,
in a 1500 weight, manned by Royal Signals personnel, whereas our front network for the battalion would be an 18 set, I think it was,
and that would be our own signalers,
and that would be our own signalers, yes, and that would go down to each company level, and probably the QM would have a set, and there would be sets for some of the what then became S Company, because head company had all the odds and ends in it,
yes,
which nobody knew what to do with. And then finally, it was decided to take the fighting elements out of headquarter company, which was then left with signals and MTO and quartermaster, and put them all into the support company, which was the carriers, the mortars, and so forth.
What sort of communications did you have in the sort of defence area in Worthing then? Were you relying on wireless there, or relying more on
lines? No, lines were put out, by the signalers.
What
field telephones, you know, the ones you wind up.
Yes. What was the plan? You know, supposing there had been an amphibious landing on the beach, what was the plan to try and hold the beach itself, or to fall back on the companies on the
well, initially we tried to drive them back in the sea whilst they were vulnerable. in the same way as that Rommel wanted to do it in Normandy, but wasn't allowed to. Obviously, when they're disembarking, that is the time when you really need to employ the full firepower you can.
Did you have artillery dedicated to...
Yes, there was artillery there, and we had FOOs up with us, yes, as well, yes.
Do you know where
25 pounders, yes, from the division.
Do you know where the guns were? Were they...
25 pounders.
Do you know where they were?
Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon.
Yes,
I don't know where the gun lines were, no. They must have been just behind Worthing, I suppose. Mm.